Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, how do you measure community well-being? In economics and in politics, well-being is often defined by the GDP, the gross domestic product. And that's a set formula that represents the value of all the goods and services produced in an economy within a certain time frame. So about every quarter, every 3 months, the ABS, the Bureau of Statistics, releases a number that represents the GDP for that period, and that allows comparisons to be made. Has the economy grown or shrunk in the previous quarter? How's it going compared with the previous year? And then there's this other thing that's GDP per capita, that is GDP divided by the number of people in the country, which lets you then compare economies of a different size on a per capita basis. In fact, the latest GDP figures released just last week showed a low rate of growth over the past 12 months. I guess, if nothing else, it demonstrates one of the reasons the Reserve Bank is keeping interest rates on hold at the moment. Because growing GDP means growing jobs. That could mean growing wages, but we're just not seeing that. And the jobs that are created in this country are largely part-time at the moment. When you drill down into the numbers, they show how important it is, by the way, that we keep our trade clean and as competitive as possible. So that Twitter promise of Donald Trump this week to protect Australia from his tariff wall is really important. So the GDP is undoubtedly very important, but does it give a full picture of the well-being of our society? And here's the important question that governments, especially progressive governments, have wondered about for some time. What are you missing if you base policy decisions on the GDP alone? Now, the latest government to tackle that issue is the New Zealand Labor government of Jacinda Ardern. She wants other measurements about people and the environment to be reported and to feed into government policy, an approach that's sometimes called a triple bottom line approach. Her words for it are people, place and profit. An economist with a good grasp of all of that, and it must be said a degree of scepticism about whether that'll make any difference, is Nicholas Gruen. He's the CEO of Lateral Economics here in Australia. Now, in this fascinating, wide-ranging discussion, we move from triple bottom line reporting to the very basis of our well-being, the beginnings of economic theory, and the similarities between a profit, people, place approach with biblical ideas about people and society. We began by talking about the New Zealand Prime Minister's approach.
What she's done is she's produced some targets or some clear measurements of things like child poverty. I think that's a great thing to do. I think it's a great thing to be focusing on those things. And if you want to be thinking about the health of our economy in 5, 10, 20 and 30 years' time, that's more important than lots of the debates that dominate our airwaves, like workplace relations and things like that. Even though I'm not saying they're unimportant, and I'm not taking anybody's side on that, but they're relatively much less important than how we treat our kids in this generation, because they're in a horrible economic expression. That's the human capital for the future.
Well, I think the catch cry there is profit, people and place, human capital being the people part. Yep. And I would think that it's a very good thing for a treasurer to sit down, or the head of treasury and then the cabinet to sit down and look at a series of measures that include how many kids are growing up in poverty, because they have a direct correlation with the well-being not only of those children, but society itself within 7, 15, 21 years.
Yeah, totally true. Totally agree. The only question is, and this is something we're now all very aware of, governments say nice things all the time, and doing this is much harder than saying it. So we've had, for instance, closing the gap. Mm-hmm. So Kevin Rudd was going to close the gap. Remember that? That was about how we were going to make sure that Aboriginal Australians were doing as well as other Australians. Well, that hasn't gone anywhere. We've spent lots of money on it, and it's gone nowhere. The Treasury, the Australian Treasury, in around about 2000 and not sure exactly when, 2003, under the supervision of Ken Henry, introduced a thing called a well-being framework, yes, which talked about these kinds of things.
Well, a lot of us got excited about that at the time, but what happened to it? Where did
it go? Well, nothing. It was a nice thing to say. Various people gave speeches about it. Everyone said it was a good idea. And the whole idea was that that the Treasury was going to focus on questions other than GDP. Now, to some extent, it does do that, especially where there are political imperatives or it thinks that there is a particular case for doing so. But if you pay attention to the framework and you pay real attention, as I have in some of the articles that I've written on it, I think it's a reasonable inference to make that the framework made no difference to the actual policies that it recommended. It just gave a bunch of talking points that you could use in speeches when you were going to be doing, when you were going to be talking about education or the environment or something like that. And the proof of that pudding is that the new Secretary of the Treasury doesn't like the wellbeing framework and got rid of it, and that made no difference as well. Have you noticed that Treasury doesn't have a wellbeing framework?
No, I have. No. I admit I had not noticed that.
So that's and this is happening all over the place. You know, governments make announcements. We're going to cut back on red tape. They do that roughly every 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
They announce a 10-year program, and then 3 years later, they announce another 10-year program. So this is this is now a well-documented phenomenon. I don't want to speak too skeptically of the New Zealand government. I think good on them for what they've done. But the proof of the pudding is there's a lot more eating to be done before we get there's a lot more pudding making and baking before we do any eating from the pudding.
Our guest on Open House is Nicholas Gruen, an economist who's the CEO of Lateral Economics. Well, economics started as a discipline that was about the well-being of people, and there's a good strong link between economics and at least a God-centered view of the world, if not a Christian view of the world, going back to the founder of modern economics, but that's a story for another day. Can I ask you this?
I could tell you about that if you want, but that can be another day. Yes, go on.
All right. Can I ask you this? Is this a failure of politics, as you've kind of posited, or is it a failure of economics? Is it that economics does not hold all the levers to create a better society?
Well, no, it's quite obvious that economics doesn't. I mean, you wouldn't expect it to. It's got some, there are things we know in the discipline of economics that are useful, but yes, the sort of things that I've been talking about where we, go on and on with endless announcements and what is now called announceables. That's a pathology of politics the way it's practiced now. Politicians feel the need, and the media imposes the need for them to react instantly. So I remember quite a long time ago, you might too, maybe it was 15, 20 years ago, there was a massive pile-up on the highway from Sydney to Brisbane, but not the one on the not the Princes Highway on the coast, but the one inland. I don't know whether you know the name of that.
The New England Highway.
New England Highway. So there was a massive pile-up. So the Premier of New South Wales and maybe the Prime Minister all came out with statements, I don't know, that day or the next day about what was going to be done about this. Now, they didn't know what to do about it. I mean, how can you possibly know what to do about it if you don't know whether you should do something about it? Every now and again, there's a massive pile-up. The responsible answer would be, firstly, we don't know what the answer is right now, and we've got a process underway, and within a month I'll be telling you some things about what our findings are.
Yeah.
But currently we think that the amount of investment we've put into that road is about right, and these are the reasons. And this is a terrible accident, but it doesn't mean that we need to respond like Pavlov's dogs to it.
To extend that a little bit further, because I think this is a great example, you look at the Pacific Highway, which has for decades been the cause of dreadful accidents, multiple fatalities all the time. Yep. And ask any government in New South Wales, at least for the last 30 years, they'll say to you, we have a program to improve this so that it's separated carriageway all the way. Well, the program still isn't completed. They've been talking about it and making incremental investments for 30 years. But if you had your profit people place index before you, you'd say, here's some spending that would make a very big impact on the people part of the equation, because we wouldn't be killing as many on this road.
Well, you would, but if you know how many people are killed on that road, I suspect it's maybe 10 or 15 or 20 a year. Now, that sounds, that immediately makes me sound very callous, because I'm saying, oh, well, what's 10 or 15 or 20 people a year?
Yes.
But the fact is that I expect I could, I mean, we could spend that money trying to reduce the level of domestic violence. We could go to fewer wars. We could try to reduce the number of fatalities in hospitals, which are of the thousands of fatalities in hospitals from errors that the hospital system introduces.
So hygiene control and so on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when you start, so this is very good. When you start reducing it to those measures, you do come to a place, don't you? And now I might get you to tell me about Adam Smith, the founder of economics, because you get to a place where you say, guess what? You can't measure the value of a person only by dollars. And we have to have some other sense of what human life is about.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So Adam Smith wrote two books in his life. He wrote one in 1759, long time ago, but it had its 250th birthday not that long ago. And it was, his first book was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And what he was trying to do was, he was trying to work out, what is it about human beings that means that, you know, we start off with a bunch of human beings and then we end up with families and villages and a nation built around those villages. That was the sort of, he's not that long after Isaac Newton. And what Isaac Newton did was, he explained the movement of the celestial heavens, as they called them in those days. He explained the movement of the heavenly bodies, the planets, the sun, and so on, in terms of a single principle. And so Smith was looking for a way to explain the way human life was.
The old theory of everything, the unification theory.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So he wrote two books, and both of those books had a single principle in them. Mm. The first book he wrote was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and was about human beings' natural sense that they understand that they're with other human beings and they care about other human beings, if only to worry about how those other people, think about us. And so his idea was that human society is built from that basic instinct, and there's also morality comes into it, because, as he said, human beings don't only want to be loved; they want to be lovely. They want not just approbation, as he called it, or people to think well of them, but deserved approbation. And once you want people to like you and you want to be likable, then you're in a human society in which virtue is possible and collective activity becomes possible. So that's his first book. And it was a great book, even though no one's ever heard of it anymore.
Do you know,
and
you
then
can
he wrote
derive
the
these
nations about economies.
Yeah, no, that's right. You can derive these principles, profit, people, place, from biblical principles. Profit, well, in the Old Testament, even though they're in exile, God's people are told to work for the prosperity of the land that they're in, because then it'll be their prosperity as well. Mm. And as far as people is concerned, well, a person's identity and dignity derives from being in the image of God. And place, well, the first job that we were given as human beings was to look after the place God had given us. So these are, it's interesting, isn't it, to look across disciplines like economics and see these sort of wholehearted biblical principles at play.
They're deep echoes, and you know, there are, every culture has different ways of referring to these kind of immortal and immutable human givens. And yeah, economics is one, or the economics, certainly the economics of Smith, Adam Smith, the person we've been talking about, is a quite a rich way to talk about it. Whereas, unfortunately, in modern economics, we just say we take a lot of things for granted, and then we say everybody's. Then we, when we build economic models, inside those economic models, we have human beings who are only selfish. Now, Adam Smith thought human beings were selfish, and human beings are selfish, but they're much more than just selfish. They, you and I, having this conversation, are not being, if we each become too selfish, we have a worse conversation.
we can compete with each other, or we can cooperate with each other.
Yes.
And we're going to have a much better time if we're cooperating to a substantial extent.
Well, and I've long thought that if only we had these conversations in lieu of what takes place, what passes for political debate in this country, if we talked about the well-being of others, wouldn't it be a better place?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We'll have to come back on that question for sure, because I completely agree. And now, here's a thought for you, though. There are two ways to represent the people. The one we've fallen for, the one we've completely signed over to, is by elections. But we also have another means of representing the people, which is the way we do it in a court case, which is via a jury. And that way, we just round up some average people, put them together and say, if you can all agree on something, we're going to say that you stand for the community. And the difference there is that I call that unitary decision-making as opposed to competitive decision-making, because in an election, you can't represent the people until you beat somebody else who wants to represent the people. Mm. And once you win your election to Parliament, you join a side which is trying to beat another side. So that antagonism, polarization is built into the very fabric of everything we do in our democracy. And we desperately need to introduce this other method, which is, well, there's a whole bunch of people here and we've got to work out what our problems are and what we're going to do about them without trying to take advantage of each other and competing with each other before we even get out of the gate.
Nicholas Gruen, so what a fascinating guy. He's the CEO of Lateral Economics. Like his approach and...
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.